Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Aaron Brown. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is It's a Jetsons World. We're doing a book review of Jeffrey Tucker's book. It's on the Radio Free Market Facebook page. Again, it's called It's a Jetsons World. It's free online at Mises.org. We should have Jeff on the line with us in a few minutes. Jeff is the former editor of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and he's now the new editor of Laissez-Faire Books. Jeff has just a really interesting take on just on economics and how it relates to, you know, entrepreneurship, and just kind of he among most of the scholars that I listen to has just a very inspiring way of looking at free market capitalism, voluntary interaction, and his book It's a Jetsons World is kind of just showing how, you know, in the Jetsons these people have all these tools that are kind of predictive of what we have in real life. We'll be right back. We're coming to a break real quick. Be right back. Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Aaron Brown. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is The World No One Will Ever Tell You Is Possible, and this is a show based off Jeffrey Tucker's book, It's a Jetsons World. It is free online at Mises.org. I'm sure it's been reposted all over the place. It's free PDF where you can order it. But I posted on the Radio Free Market Facebook page if you want to read the book after you listen to the interview. Jeff has just a really great way of kind of bringing us back to the realization of how great the free market is, and how I can, in California right now, plug in a couple wires and click a couple buttons, and all of a sudden I'm able to, you know, to talk to Jeffrey Tucker in Alabama and broadcast out to however many people are listening. This is, you know, and we just kind of forget because it's always around, and that, you know, the newest technology is coming out by the minute, and we very rarely stop to just appreciate that this is. This happened because of the free and voluntary market. And it seems like his whole task, the whole book, is just to show us that the free market will provide the things that we need. But if there's this other force that's kind of slowing down this progress, and that's the Leviathan state that tries to regulate every single aspect of our life, the first example, and he should be here on the air soon, he gives an example. You know, everyone thinks that the law of the land is the United States Constitution, and that's what governs the country. These are the laws that govern the country. But he makes that, I didn't even really know too much about this before I read this. Now, he said really what actually regulates our lives is the United States Code, which now stands at almost 356,000 pages long. And it covers every aspect of our lives, from what kind of mattress you can sell, to when your kids must go to school, the shape of water bottles. I know that Democrats tend to be in favor, not that I'm a Republican, I'm just picking on Democrats specifically here for a second. Even a Democrat, you've got to look at 356,000 pages of federal regulation. And that doesn't include the state and local, county, and, you know, this is just federal, you know, 356,000 pages of federal regulation. So, I mean, even if you're in favor of, you know, regulation, whatever that means subjectively to each person, but I'm just kind of using it in the broad sense, doesn't a Democrat have to look at that and say, wow, I'm in favor of regulation, but wow, that is a lot of rules. And you wonder why, you wonder why we're in such a slump. There's so many rules. It's the hardest thing to do is to start up a business. All these rules are, they're certainly not meant to help the common man. It's certainly not for the common good. It's to, they work to protect the people at the top, and it prevents the little guy from moving in. Jeff wrote a couple times in this book that government, it's an anachronism. It kind of gums up the real world of process and innovation. And when he gets on the air here, I wanted to get him to expand on the idea. Has government, yes, government now it's an anachronism. It's with the advent of kind of mass technology and the internet, it seems like government is now even at more so than other times obsolete. And I wanted to get him to comment on the question of, has government, even before this time period, has government ever been useful and or necessary at any time, even when society wasn't so industrial? And we'll talk about the difference between a wonk and a geek. We're going to talk about a little bit. Jeff is Catholic, I believe, and he put in some good religious references. He talked about the Jewish, the Jewish code, kind of collection of Jewish law. It kind of mandates, if you will, there's a place in this kind of collection of Talmudic law and other law that says that the Torah is supposed to be a free good, that you are prohibited as a rabbi or a teacher from profiting from the dissemination of Torah knowledge. And this is a quote from Jeff's book. He says, he can charge for time, the use of a building, the books. Hello, Jeff?
Yes.
Hi, Mr. Tucker. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm sorry. I'm late coming in. What a bum. I'm really embarrassed.
No. It's okay. I just got on the air. We just moved to our new show time at 4
okay.
p.m. I did have a show in the morning, and so you weren't very late at all because
okay.
we had about a 5-minute period at the beginning where we accidentally
perfect.
Had some old footage play. So
you are
right on time.
Okay.
So this is Jeffrey Tucker, ladies and gentlemen. Please, again, we're also doing a promotion. Come in, call into the show. You can ask Jeff or I your question, and we will send you a free copy of Ron Paul's Case for Gold. So please call in. So, Jeff, how are you?
Everything's going great. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, I'm so glad. I just read, I kind of burned through about 150 pages of your book, and then I went back to start up writing questions. This book is not just one interview. This is really a whole kind of world view. This is a long, really dense, good book, a lot of material.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you like it. Now, we're talking about Jeff's world, and, that has a lot of material I explore the subject of intellectual property at some length, and the reason I do that is that, well, there's several reasons. One is it's a difficult topic, and it's one of those that challenges the way we think about things in ways that maybe we haven't been challenged before. Libertarians imagine that we're believers in property rights, but it turns out when faced with issues of intellectual property that we're not entirely sure what we mean by that, which is a little bit of a shocking claim, but I think it's true. So I came to the conclusion gradually over the course of 6 or 7 years that there is no such thing to intellectual property as intellectual property, and I wanted to kind of walk the reader through the intellectual process that led to that dawning realization.
Jeff, coming up to our first break. I'm so sorry to interrupt you.
Yep,
we will be right back on.
Okay.
We're just about to come up to a break. We will be right back on Radio Free Market. Please stay with me and Jeff Tucker. Hello, America. We are back on Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Darren Brown. We are here with Jeffrey Tucker talking about his new book, It's a Jetsons World. I'm sorry to cut you off.
But not at all.
Please continue with that thought.
Yeah, I was going to say that. So one of the problems is that the subject is particularly difficult. difficult and challenging for libertarians, it helps to think through it because it helps clarify one's perspective on this extremely important topic that turns out to be, you know, gigantically important in terms of policy today. But the other thing is that the topic itself leads to other profound implications in terms of the way we look at the world. And I try to highlight this in the book, that it broadens the Austrian, I guess you could say, point of view to looking just beyond issues of the market as a competitive and cooperative process, to looking at it as a kind of place for learning and emulation as an essential part of the market process and the development of society itself. So then if you understand the issues of IP, then you can kind of begin to understand and imagine this huge role that learning plays in the formation development of society itself. So that's why I focus on the topic to such an extent. Well, and in addition, the book focuses, you know, largely on the role of digital media in reinventing our age.
Yes, I really like the piece on BitTorrents. There hasn't been a whole lot. I read your section on BitTorrent, and then I realized I hadn't really read anything ever that really talked about how amazing a technology BitTorrent is. You can just, yeah. I mean, you can find anything.
Yeah. You get on it. It's like downloading the state of California or something.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I downloaded a free program the other day called, you know, WebZipper or something like that. Downloaded it, and in about 2 seconds, I had set in motion the download of the entire Mises.org website, like seven links out. Right to my external hard drive. It's going in the background. Everything else is running about the same speed. It's really an incredible thing. I really like your book because it really tell us a little bit about, because I would like to hear from kind of your own mouth. Your style is kind of just to bring us back to the very simple realization that, you know, the market it is good, and we really don't certainly I don't know we don't realize enough that the market
we don't
is good.
See it, right. Well, you know, I believe very strongly that the ideas we hold in our head profoundly affects the way we look at the world. And economics, in a general category, and market-style thinking in a more specific area, can elude us because we're so surrounded by it. I mean, the market is everywhere. It's a part of everything we do from morning to night. Everything we love in this world is, to some extent, related to market logic. And the problem is that it's so big, so omnipresent, and the improvements in our standard of living are so constant and relentless that, ironically, we would tend to miss them unless we stop for a second and think about it. And that's what I try to do in the book, is stop and think about particular issues that we confront every day for which there are market-style solutions. And I'm hoping that the purpose in doing that, really, is to make us more conscious of the reality that freedom is the answer to the improvement of human well-being. And I do this through very small ways, just finding small issues, because I think that helps us think about things. And from those small issues, then I always try to draw a bigger, more general lesson out of them. And I think that if you follow the logic carefully, you come to the conclusions I've come to, which is that the state is a purely destructive institution, and all the beauty and creativity and wonders that we have in the world are first of all, by any standard, miraculous, by the standards of history, but are entirely man-made within the context of voluntary exchange. So that's the dominant theme of the book. Essentially, I'm arguing that that the idea of anarchism, for lack of a better term, the capacity of humanity to cooperate without coercion, is the primary means by which we come to live happy and fulfilling lives. And if you just recognize that, then we'll have a kind of, I guess you'd say, political agenda for ourselves built in into our heads, which is namely to get the thing out of the way that's forestalling further progress, and that thing is always and everywhere, the state. So that's I would say, the thesis of the book.
You put in, I'm Jewish, so this really caught my eye, and it was just, I really wanted to get you to comment on it. I skipped like four questions because I need you to comment on this. You wrote a little bit about the Jewish, I guess it's halakhic code that prohibits it, and this, the halakhic code is, I guess, is a collection of Jewish law, I guess, is that did I research correctly?
Well, you have to tell me a little bit more. You have to refresh my memory about this particular point.
Okay, you wrote about this Jewish kind of collection of law that prohibits a rabbi or a teacher from profiting from the dissemination of Torah knowledge.
And he
can charge for time, the use of a building and books, but not the knowledge itself, because the Torah is supposed to be a free good.
That's right. That is exactly right. Yeah, that's a brilliant passage because it foreshadows, of course, I mean, that same ethos was also lasted into Christianity as well, and many other world religions, and any body of truth. So yes, that was the Jewish principle that you can't charge for knowledge. You know, the means of delivery can be charged for because those themselves can be scarce. But the non-scarce thing is a free good, and this is an extremely important point. And I've written quite a lot about this. The market generates every day and constantly, relentlessly, new forms of information for us. And those forms of information surround us constantly, and we're always and everywhere drawing from them as a way of improving our capacity to sort of navigate this world. And it is a free good. So, in other words, people are always saying about capitalism that, well, it's a system that generates profits, you know, for the few. Well, I mean, let's grant that maybe that's true, that is a certain privatization of profit that goes on. But there's a sort of socialistic or communistic element of capitalism itself, namely that it's also generating, at the same time, a relentless well of information that's being broadcast to us on a constant and relentless basis. And in fact, it's impossible to be successful as an entrepreneur without more or less giving away the secret to your success all the time. I mean, if in your community there's a very profitable donut shop, the guy who owns the place is making a lot of money, maybe the employees are making a lot of money, that's the privatized element of the donut shop. The public or socialist or communistic element of the donut shop is that he's broadcasting to the whole community, here's a way to make money. Sell donuts in this town. If he had a stick, maybe he'd rather not do that, but that's what goes with the territory. So there's two sides of the coin always working in the capitalist world. There's the free good that's always being produced, and then there's the private good that is a little bit more iffy. In a way, you know, but the successful entrepreneur is always broadcasting the secrets to success, and that Jewish principle you mentioned is a beautiful illustration of it.
Jeff, I'm sorry to catch you off. It looks like we're coming up quickly to a break here. We will be right back with Jeff Tucker on Into Jeff's World. Stay with me on Radio Free Market. Hello, America and the world. We are back on Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Aaron Brown. We are here with Jeffrey Tucker, who is now the executive editor of Laissez-Faire Books. Jeff, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you, but please
give
that thought on knowledge is free goods.
Yes. Well, Mises mentions this briefly in some of his work, and Menger mentions this briefly in some of his work, and Rothbard does too, and Hayek discusses it somewhat. But, you know, the digital age has presented with this problem and this issue in a more sort of crystallized way, so that libertarians have to kind of come to terms with this aspect of life that hasn't really been a big problem with us. I mean, Mises talked about knowledge of the free good within the context of recipes. Like, for example, if I tell you how to make biscuits, then you know how to make biscuits. You can take that recipe with you, and it doesn't somehow take it away from me, right? We know this. But the digital age has shown us that it's not just about recipes. It's about practically everything. It's everything that we know. Quite often we're, most of what we know, we've extracted the information from other sources, and we put it together on our own lens and make up our own remix of that information. Now, if you have a, I was going to say that one of the things that characterizes the digital age is a kind of migration. It's like the great 19th century migration from Europe to America. Well, the digital age, we've seen this gigantic migration from the world of scarce goods into the world of non-scarce goods. So we've seen a migration of music out of kind of scarce media into non-scarce media. It's been true with books. It's been true with paintings. And now with 3D printing, it's even going to be true with objects. So, and it's happening more and more every day. I mean, that's what we're confronting. When we see a new piece of software that we're blown away by, like we pay $10 a month and we can get, you know, tens of thousands of immediately accessible songs, this represents a migration from the old physical world where these things were tied up on vinyl, going back a century earlier when you could only hear these kind of things live, to the non-scarce world of digital media. And that has profound implications for free market logic. And it also has presents an amazing sort of challenge to this old-time government system of attempting to use the law to restrict our capacity to learn and use new ideas that are non-scarce goods. So, I think the implications of this is that we have to get rid of intellectual property law, or else we're going to be doomed. I mean, right now, every day we're seeing more and more efforts by government authorities and regulators to try to shut down digital media, precisely because of this miraculous capacity for infinite reproducibility that's embedded in the structures of the digital world itself. And unless we stop them, I mean, they can throw history back, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 years. And that's, I think, the great threat that we're facing right now, which is why libertarians need to get busy and think about these issues.
Mm-hmm. And we have about till I think 58 minutes for the end of this first hour, but I wanted to get you to comment on that exact point, what you were just telling about. There's a chapter in your book where if you're listening to the show and you don't really get why intellectual property is so great, I'm going to help you right now. I'm going to get Jess to comment on this. You were digging up things out of a desk of yours that you were cleaning out. And you said you just came to the realization of how amazing the digitization of life is. That you had all these old documents and journals that cost you, you know, $80 to get the physical copy. And now, you know, you, Jeff Tucker, you can consume a news article and your consumption doesn't affect your consumption of that article tomorrow, nor does it affect any other person on a planet's ability to consume that article. So in the last kind of 6 minutes here, just expand on that and tell us that's an amazing thing. And you point you
well,
very, very
I'm glad you said something about this, because I do think it's extremely important for people to understand what makes intellectual property different from real property. and I'll just illustrate this by pointing out that if you hear anything in this interview that you find compelling and you want to repeat to somebody else, you're having repeated that to somebody else doesn't somehow take those thoughts or ideas or my capacity to express them away from me. They're still with me. I mean, in other words, I'm not going to wake up at midnight and find myself unable to speak, unable to think those same thoughts again, right? Whereas if you steal the planter from my front porch, or you steal my car or whatever, I no longer have use of that. There's a conflict over the use of those resources. But in the world of ideas, there is no conflict over the use of resources at all. You can use them, I can use them, 7 billion people can use them. Not just now, but for all time. I mean, we're still using the ideas of Plato and Aristotle and Maimonides and St. Thomas. They're all long dead, and yet their ideas are immortal. So that's what makes ideas different. They are infinitely reproducible, and they're immortal in the sense that they far outlast our lifetime. None of this is true of property. You know, property goes the way of all flesh. I mean, real property does. It's a constantly depreciating, and if you have it, I can't have it. If I have it, you can't have it. That's not true in the world of ideas. So once you understand this, you know, it has amazing implications for economics. I mean, one is that any enterprise that can somehow successfully commercialize ideas has the opportunity for infinite scalability. In other words, the marginal cost of each additional user of that information falls to zero. And that's how come, for example, Google is the world's most lucrative company, you know, today. So, and that's, if you're looking for places to put your money, you need to put them in places that are working with scalable media like this. It also has incredible implications for our government policy. So if you want to keep your ideas scarce and you want to charge people for the use of them, there's nothing in the world wrong with that. There's nothing unlibertarian about that. The key thing is that you can't use the state to do it. And if you do use the state to do it, you know better than some mercantilist in the 15th century who, sold the king their salt or silk monopoly. It's no different from that old-time feudal system. And that's essentially what we're talking about, intellectual property rights, is a kind of a continuation of the old mercantilist feudalist system. And that's why I think it can just go away completely, and it would be the best thing that ever happened to entrepreneurship in the world today.
Mm-hmm. And some people would be. It's interesting how when it comes down to issues of the state, even if you present the, you know, everyone wants things for free. I mean, everyone's always complaining.
Right.
I don't mean complaining in the sense that they're complaining, but we all want things to be lower cost. This is one thing that could be free. Yet when we start to talk about the state and intellectual property, you say, hey, let's just make this not free. You can charge whatever you want for it, but you shouldn't be allowed to use aggressive violence to create a market for it. People are right. just flabbergasted, and then they're just, no. Oh my God, you know, like Tom Wood says, you know, the earth is going to break free of its axis and it goes spinning towards the sun.
People get very scared of this, but you know, I think that just reflects the kind of lack of imagination that happens when you have the state involved in some particular area for as long as it has been. People can't imagine any other reality. I mean, if we had a system where the government was the exclusive supplier of shoes, and somebody came along and said, "Hey, why don't we just have a market? You know, where anybody can make a shoe and sell it." You know, you would get the hordes of people going, "Well, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. That's never going to work. Nobody's ever going to make a shoe. How's that going to happen?" You know, and we're all going to be walking around on our bare feet. I mean, that's the immediate prediction you'd have. So that's people's normal reactions when you talk about getting rid of intellectual property. People are just mortified at the prospect, and they think that it's going to destroy creativity, which is crazy, or whatever you may. Nightmare scenario you can come up with. This is a problem I think that freedom advocates have. We know that freedom is productive, it's creative, it's beautiful, it's going to solve so many of our problems, and yet we don't know precisely how that's going to happen, so we can't lay out a definitive scenario, and that's one of the beauties of the market. That it's always doing something we don't expect it to do. So that was really the purpose of my book, is to kind of inspire people to kind of be willing to take the leap, the intellectual leap, and say, yeah. Well, I don't know
Jeff,
exactly.
It looks like we're coming up to a break pretty quick. I'm sorry. I'm hearing the music. Yep, there's the music. We will be right back on Radio Free Market at about 5:08. So we're at about a 10-minute break, and we will be back with Jeff Tucker talking about. I live in Los Angeles, and there are eight FedExes around me. Yet they all, or you know, FedExes and UPSs and you know, post offices. I don't know how that's still there, but they're all these post offices around me, and none of them are going out of business, and I can, you know, send my mail, you know, for a quarter, I can walk up with my iPhone and email them my document right there, and they'll spit out a label, you know, just a couple years ago you couldn't do this.
So yeah, we haven't got that. Everything's changing. Yeah, everything's changing so dramatically, and it's all because of the market and the terrible trend. You know, I suppose if you lived during the Industrial Revolution, you'd have a profound sense that a lot of things are changing, maybe, but would you have necessarily appreciated that it was the market doing it? I don't know. But I just don't, I mean, we're all very, very privileged to be alive in these times. Of the digital age, which I date from beginning in 1995, essentially from the invention of the web browser. And we've seen history on fast forward in service of human well-being, you know, ever since. And I just don't think that any of us can let this beautiful example before our eyes let it go without making the point and somehow calling out to our fellow men and women the essential message that it's human liberty that is giving us these blessings. First of all, they are blessings.
Yes.
You know, the state of nature, we're living in caves. We're not living in caves, and the reason is because of the
market.
It
looks like we're coming up to a break pretty quick here. I'm sorry to interrupt. We will be right back with Jeff Tuck on Radio Free Market. Stay with us. Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Aaron Brown. We are here with Jeff Tucker talking about his book, It's a Jetsons World, if you're just tuning in. Jeff, you had an interesting social olive bar sampling. This is a really good example. You show how people, even when there's the opportunity to be greedy, like in the olive bar example where, you know, you go into Whole Foods and you know, there's an olive bar there, and you could just stick your grubby hand in there and take a whole handful of olives and run out, I guess. I guess you could do that. That is possible in that situation because it's kind of left open. But, you know, most people might grab a couple, but, you know, more often than not during your little experiment, you know, people's kind of sense of fairness, no one really did anything awful. I think there was maybe one guy who took some and then didn't buy.
Yeah. Well, this is an I found this a fascinating case to me because as libertarians we believe in property rights, and so we want to have some sense of when it's stealing and when it's not stealing, right? So I began to kind of be bugged by this, mainly because, you know, at the olive bar, I would go by and I would grab an olive sometimes. I would feel terrible about it. But then I would kind of go back and buy a bunch of olives, and so I'd pay these exorbitant prices for these olives, almost as a kind of propitiation for my sin, you know. And so then I got curious. I said, why am I having the other people are doing this? So I got some people, and we staked out the olive bar on a Saturday afternoon. I assigned one person over in the bread section to look, and another from another angle, and we took careful calculations of how many people were stealing from the olive bar. And we found out that vast numbers were stealing from the olive bar. But then also vast numbers of stealers were also buying olives. So I got curious, what is the store policy towards the olive bar? Is it stealing to take an olive or not? And I asked the guy in the wine section. He said, oh, no, it's not a problem. Everybody steals olives all the time. That's fine. Therefore, it's okay with us. The lady in the bread section said, no, that's flat-out theft. Anybody who would take an olive without paying for it is a thief. So then I asked the manager of the store, and he just kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, well, you know, I'm not entirely sure, but somehow it all works out. But I concluded from this experiment that the grocery store actually had every intention of maintaining a certain degree of what I call rule ambiguity there, precisely because it turns out to be profitable. In other words, every customer kind of goes through what I went through, this temptation to grab an olive, stick it in your mouth, then trying to figure out what to do with the seed that's stuck in your cheek for the rest of the time you're shopping. But then also people are buying, and the thing ends up being profitable, in part because of the rule ambiguity. And I suppose that my lesson here is that these olives are all Kroger's olives. If they want to permit a certain degree of sampling, that's entirely up to them, and that's what they found to be the profitable model. So I found the thing to be extremely interesting study of the relationship between property rights, private management of a firm, and also the interrelationship between the human conscience conscience and the commercial impulse. So that was the upshot of that article. I really enjoyed writing it, mainly because I do this with a lot of my articles. I try to find some puzzle I want to solve, and I just kind of investigate it until the answer presents itself.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I particularly like the Olive Bar story because, you know, if your the goal of this book was, again, to kind of ease people into rejecting intellectual property, and I thought it was great because the, you know, there's kind of the biggest part of the argument that I hear pro intellectual property from kind of the layperson is that they're going to lose money. Well, okay, but we've just showed you that it is actually not the case that without intellectual property, people will not make a profit. In fact, they probably will make more because there is kind of this like you said, there's this kind of social, you know, capitalism doesn't have to be completely divorced from socialistic ideas. Everyone's
right.
Kind of in, whole, you know, the Whole Foods down the street. Everyone's kind of walking around, getting samples from here and there, even if oftentimes they don't even intend on, like, I'll go get a sample of a slice of pizza. I don't really intend on getting a slice of pizza. I'm actually going to get Chinese food. But you know what? They'll give it to me because they know I'm in the store. And, you know, after, you know, 10 or 20 visits to that store, you kind of be able to come of faith. It becomes a community type of thing. Yeah, come have a sample. And so anyone who says that capitalism cannot be communal and, kind of feel good in a socialistic sort of way, I just don't think, I think that's why sometimes even with family or people who we really want to listen, I guess I can only speak for myself, when you try to get them to understand these ideas, it sometimes is, you just want to get through to them so bad because you, it really is, kind of, it is, like you said, it's the best of kind of both worlds. Everyone can agree on a system like this.
Yeah, no, that's, I think you're precisely right. And, you know, I don't know if you're an admirer of Ayn Rand. I was thinking today about Ayn Rand because I obviously disagree very profoundly with the way she presented the core ethics of the market. I don't agree with her characterization of the capitalistic process. But I was thinking today that, you know, I still like her very much and I like her writings very much. And I it's almost to the point that I feel like I'm allowed to criticize Ayn Rand, but it's like you are with your brother or sister. Like, you're allowed to criticize, but nobody else is. Yeah, so I feel that way about Ayn Rand. But I think in some ways, her characterization of the market as this kind of greedy thing that, you know, rewards some people and to heck with the rest, it's just, it couldn't be more incorrect, really. That's just, that's not what we see in the real world. That's not the way, entrepreneurs are. You know, it's funny. Anytime I walk into any retail store, there's going to be somebody come up to me and say, can I help you? And the normal impulse from a lot of people is to say, you know, leave me alone. I just want to shop. You know, okay, well, that's fine. They let you alone and let you shop. But what about the fact that somebody's coming up to you saying, can I help you? I mean, that itself is a very beautiful institution. I mean, there's somebody that greets you. You've not spent a dime. You've not done anything. They don't even know you from Adam. You've walked into this place, and they're coming up to you and saying, I want to help you. That's a beautiful thing. I mean, that's a wonderful institution. You are being served. You don't want that service? Okay, you can refuse it. But appreciate just for a second what it means that we have institutions where there's somebody coming up that genuinely and totally wants to help you. Now you could say, oh no, they just want my money. Well,
Jeff, I think we might be losing you a little bit. I'm going to mute you for 1 second. It looks like his mic was cutting out a little bit. But, you know, when he gets back on the show, I want to, Jeff, can you hear me now?
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah, there we go.
Okay.
There we go, that's better. Got some interference.
Right.
Continue that point. Sorry, you got cut off a little bit.
No, I was just saying it's a beautiful thing that somebody wants to help us. That's a great thing. And you could say, wow, they just want my money. Well, not really. What they want to do is they want to give you something in exchange for you giving them something. In other words, they're seeking an opportunity for a mutual gift-giving opportunity where you gain value and they gain value. That's called human cooperation. And there's nothing wrong with that. And that's something that's the very essence of the commercial exchange. And nothing we should ever put down or take for granted.
So when we go into a burger restaurant, Yona, I always remark to my family, I say, hey, isn't that great? You came in here, you sat down, you don't know these people. These people do not know you. They don't particularly care about you or your well-being, but they are going to, like, slave over you for the next 45 minutes while you eat your meal.
That's right.
You know,
yeah, we
that,
marvel
that's
about...
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
And we have about 1 minute left.
Yeah.
Actually, there's the music right now. Stay with us on Radio Free Market. We'll be back right after the break. Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Aaron Brown. We are back with Jeff Tucker. Jeff, finish that thought. We were talking about, where did we leave off? I can't even remember what point we left off on.
Well, about the market as a place of generosity and giving, which is just a kind of a constant theme of mine. I think it's really a mistake for us to put too sharp a divide between private interests and public interest. One thing I think we know for sure is that the state does not actually promote the public interest in any sense. This is becoming more obvious in our time, I would say, than it used to be in the past. In the past, people had some sense that the government was doing big things for them, like, you know, advancing science, like going to the moon or building a big bridge and industrializing places. Nowadays, government, the ethos of government has completely changed. Now it's all about hectoring us all the time, regulating us all the time, telling what we can't do. It's to the point in a kind of police state environment that we're in where, at least in the physical world, it's almost like if something's not mandated, it's forbidden. You know, that's sort of what it's come down to, and it's really quite pathetic.
And you know what's funny is that
the digital world.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and even in light of what you just said, all we hear from the kind of mainstream, you know, so-called intellectuals is that, you know, anyone who wishes to, you know, implement and or roll back society's laws to those laws of yesteryear and roll it back to that level of government size, you know, these are just kind of hopeless boobs who need, you know, they need someone to tell them what to do, to what the proper structure of society, you know, what's best for the common good, yada, 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 yada.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me. Yeah. That's always the characterization you hear. I think of statism as an old-fashioned system, as a kind of anachronism, an anachronistic system that was used to great effectiveness from a political point of view back in an age of where the physical world was all we had, what I like to call the analog age, you know, prior to globalization, prior to the migration of so much of the scarce world to the non-scarce world. The state was kind of master of the universe in the past. I don't see how that could possibly pertain to a digital age where we see whole worlds coming and going all the time online without the slightest bit of organizing force by some kind of overlords. You know, they simply do not exist. And the web creates it's a beautiful example of what Hayek calls spontaneous order. You know, and that example is before our eyes all the time.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, and to kind of the keeping on the point of, you know, going back to laws that are, going back to, you know, let's go back to the level of regulation, you know, 100 years ago, you write that you wrote a chapter about the minimum drinking age, and kind of it's only in people's, you know, worst nightmares about a world without government that we can even conceive of having no mandated minimum drinking age. Will you tell us a little bit about your thoughts on that chapter?
Yeah, well, now that's an interesting case because the whole the sense that people have that drinking is somehow a kind of a bad boy activity. You know, there's a derring do quality to it, and mixed drinks and drinking too much, and all the kind of things that we think of as being the cultural associations we have with drinking right now. I mean, we consume more liquor than ever, and yet we're more afraid of liquor than we've ever been before. All of that grew out of prohibition. Before prohibition, there wasn't any restrictions on drinking age. Anybody could drink anything anytime, or rather it was up to the proprietor of the bar itself. You know, if a 7-year-old came in and ordered a bourbon, it was not likely to be getting it, or the guy would have called his parents right away, you know, somebody like that. But then after prohibition, you know, everybody flagrantly violated the law, and thank goodness for that, because if they hadn't done that, we never would have gotten prohibition repealed. But then after the repeal of prohibition, we suddenly have all these new restrictions and regulations, to the point that, I tell you, the drinking laws are just outrageous. I mean, 21 years old? This is crazy. I mean, this is the most violated law in the whole country, apart from the laws against downloading songs and movies and the speeding laws. I mean, like, every young person in college today drinks, and this is well known, and yet the laws persist. It's like we're a nation of outrageous hypocrites, you know, and what's done this to us? It's been the state.
And you wrote, in that chapter, you wrote, you know, 2/3 of people under the age of 21 reported that they consumed alcohol in the previous year. And you made a good point that, well, no wonder there are so many police. You've made a whole bunch of criminals, and they have to enforce it, and they can't even enforce all of it, so it's kind of just like selective enforcement, and that leaves a lot of leeway. There's no consistent law anymore.
Yeah, you know, you hit on something extremely important there, and I'm not sure that I covered this well enough in that book, but I hope to cover it in my next book. It's about how the state has to create a criminal class to sustain its system of so-called justice. And hardly anybody wants to talk about this, but the state really feeds off lives. It's got to create criminals so it can populate its courts, so it can fill its jails, so it can keep everybody in a constant state of frenzy and fear all the time, if we can make work for judges and attorneys and all the bureaucratic apparatus. I mean, what would the state justice system, so-called, do without criminals? It needs ever more all the time, and that's why we're seeing ever more criminals created. The state itself is creating them, and if it runs out, it's got to make new ones. So, yeah, it has to pass ever new laws, and convict ever more people of even stupid violations of laws. A friend of mine the other day was drinking a beer on his front lawn, and a cop came up, and in the town where I live, they don't have a whole lot to do because real crime, actual crime, isn't that bad. So they asked him for his ID. Well, like an idiot, he presented him his fake ID. They ran it, of course, over the... Listen, even the way I'm talking, like an idiot. The only reason he has a fake ID is because of an unjust law in the first place. But anyway, they ran his ID, discovered it as a fake, they arrested him, took him to jail, and now, since he's in ROTC, he's losing his scholarship to go to school because one of the conditions of that scholarship is that he can't have any arrests, and he's going to owe the ROTC some $40,000 for all the schooling he's had so far. So suddenly this poor kid, all for drinking a beer on his front lawn, is going to be kicked out of school. He has to spend time in jail. He's got lawyer's bills like crazy. And he's got a $40,000 debt that he's got to pay right away. And he's got all for drinking a beer on his front lawn. Now, that is an outrageous disproportionate system. That doesn't make any sense, and yet that's the kind of system we have today, and I tell you, it ensnares millions of people every day. We live in a world where you can get arrested for sending the wrong tweet over your Twitter account, for drinking a beer in your front yard. There's one book, I think it's called something like 10 Felonies a Day, I think is the name of the book, where it says that we've become just a nation of lawbreakers. We're not really breaking any law in that bossy out sense. What we're doing is breaking these stupid legislative laws that shouldn't exist in the first place. The real criminals are in the public sector.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning, I think it was in the first chapter you wrote that we think we're governed by the Constitution, but it's really the United States Code that, as of 2006, was 356,000 pages long. I couldn't even believe that. When I was reading it, I thought, you know, we only have about a minute here. I'm just going to finish up this thought and then I'm going to sign off. But, you know, I was thinking even a Democrat has got to look at that, you know, not that I'm a Republican, but even a Democrat has got to look at that and say, that is a lot of rules. I mean, I'm in favor of regulation, but man, that's a lot of rules. Mr. Tucker, thank you so much for being on the show today. This was really a lot of fun. This whole 2 hours was, you know, 60 pages of the book. It's really got a lot of good stuff, loaded with good stuff. So thank you so much for coming on.
And I'm so thankful to you for having me, and I'd love to come back some other time. So please, let's keep in touch, and let's both keep thinking and keep reading.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe we'll do the next 70 pages. Thank you, everyone, for listening. This has been Aaron Brown on Radio Free Market. You can go to RadioFreeMarket.com and download all of our archives, or you can go to iTunes, where you can get all of our stuff for free. I'll see you next week, Thursday, 4 p.m. Wherever you are, stand up for freedom.